Welcome. My name is Julian Schlossberg, and the name of our show is Movie Talk. My guest today wears many hats. He's a screenwriter. He's an actor. He's a director. He's a musician. He's a playwright, an author, a stand-up. He's just a terrifically talented man. His name is Woody Allen. And Woody, I read, and you're going to have to straighten me out if this is not true, but I read that you had said that you could write before you read. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. I when I was a young person, I could make up stories, narratives and stories, and I would say them. But I said them in a literary way. I could tell the story, but I couldn't read at that time. I've never been a real reader. I mean, I can read well, but I never enjoyed reading. It was not something that gave me a lot of pleasure. Once in a while, it was okay, but I read mostly, you know, to keep up with things but not for pleasure. I don't get a lot of fun curling up with a book or something. I'd rather do almost anything else. Rather watch a movie or see a play, listen to music, or, you know, I'm just not. I was just never interested in reading.
It's so interesting too, because I think you grew up in a household without any books. There were no books there.
No books in my house. No. My father really never read. My mother truly never read. I mean, she didn't read the newspaper. My father read the newspaper, the Daily News, every morning. But no, there was no, and they never, you know, they never, there was no real culture in my house at all. They never took me to a play. I mean, never. And when I say never, I mean never. They never took me to a play. They rarely took me to a movie. I went by myself and with friends, but they never took me to see a film. They never, I would say also never in my life, took me to a museum or any kind of cultural event. They just weren't big on culture. My father was big on baseball, and my mother, you know, was a housewife. She was big on, you know, knitting and mahjong and relatives, but no culture.
And your dad had the one book, The Gangs of New York, I think.
Yeah, that was the only book he had. I never saw him reading it, but that was the only book he had.
But Cousin Rita was the answer for you. I know she was a few years older, but she exposed you to a lot of things that they did not.
I was lucky. I had a cousin who, like, she was 5 years older than me, and she liked me and took me to the movies all the time and did things with me. And yes, she was someone who I did all those things with, and took me into Manhattan all the time and you know, showed me, introduced me to her friends, took me to the beach. We talked about, you know, I was always with a group of kids that were 5 years older than me. And so they were always talking about interesting things. And, you know, it was a big help to me.
I was so interested that you called these movies, some of them that you saw, champagne comedies. And I thought, look at you. You did it in Purple Rose of Cairo. You actually had the penthouses and the people in the champagne comedies as part of your movie.
Yes, you know, I couldn't believe when I was making that movie, I couldn't believe, and I kept telling myself this audibly, like a crazy person, that I was directing Van Johnson. Because when I grew up, Van Johnson was a big movie star, a heartthrob to all the women, and a popular commercial movie star, in everything from musicals to Esther Williams picture to Army pictures. He just was, and I grew up, you know, idolizing him on the screen and thinking, my God, he epitomizes a Hollywood actor. And then I suddenly found myself on directing Van Johnson. I couldn't believe it.
Well, I had the privilege of directing him myself, where he hosted a show I did called Going Hollywood, The War Years. Because as you say, during the war, he was the number one box office star in the world. He was. And one of the reasons was he had a plate in his head. He couldn't be in the armed forces. And so so that's how he got there. But it was great that you had these champagne comedies, as you call them, and then you ended up doing one, or at least a part of one.
Yes, those were comedies that were very ubiquitous. They were ubiquitous in the 30s and the 40s, the early 40s. You know, they took place in very opulent, sophisticated places in New York, penthouses and beautiful homes. And they were, you know, the people were always popping champagne corks, and the banter was always sophisticated and witty, and the problems were always very solvable problems. You know, at the end of the movie, things always turned out okay. And these were very beautiful people, that the women were lovely and charming, and the guys were amusing and heroic. And, you know, it was a wonderful fantasy. Of course, nothing like it ever existed in real life, but it was great. We all wanted to, when I grew up in my neighborhood, we all wanted to live in one of those penthouses where the elevator opens into the apartment and the telephones are white, and there's maids and butlers, and the people dress for dinner. If you see a movie, even a later movie like the one with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, Adam's Rib, you find that there are lawyers in Manhattan living clearly like on Sutton Place somewhere, because you can see the bridge out their window. And they, when they come home, he gets into a tuxedo in his own home to have dinner in his own home. He gets into a tuxedo and she gets dressed, and they have friends come over and they dine in evening clothes. I mean, that's the way people live. Now, where I grew up, you know, you came in and you dropped into the kitchen and they slammed a plate of, you know, lamb chops or something in front of you, and nobody ate together, and no radios were blasting. Nobody dressed. They'd be in their underwear. I mean, you know, and this was a way of life that existed somewhere out there, really probably only in the movies, but you felt it existed somewhere in New York, in some of those wealthy business buildings on Park Avenue or Fifth Avenue. And it was something to fantasize about, to aspire toward, but more realistically fantasize about.
Well, you growing up in Brooklyn, me growing up in the Bronx, we kind of had neighborhoods that don't exist in much of the country any longer. We had a butcher shop, an advertising shop, a tailor shop. I go sometimes to friends' kids or grandkids. They don't know what a butcher is. They don't know what a lime is. It was a different kind of living, our neighborhoods, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. And I, of course, didn't appreciate it. In my neighborhood, there was a place where all the stores were. And in an area of about 6-7 blocks, there were two fabulous Chinese restaurants and incredible delicatessens and wonderful stores and bakeries where they bake fresh bread and cake every day. And I mean, it was just, you know, but I didn't appreciate it. I figured, you know, this is the way you go when you buy my father cigarettes, or when I go to bring my mother home a rye bread or milk or something. But those stores were wonderful, and they don't exist anymore. You don't have that kind of wonderful neighborhood, certainly not where I grew up.
No, it was great. I just loved it, as you did. So I have to talk, if you don't mind, in terms of you and I going to public schools with these teachers that at best were unhappy. and they really were strict and difficult, and they made you sit up in your chair, and there was absolutely no ability to get joy out of education from many of these women. Did you have the similar thing?
I had the exact same thing. It was the opposite of what you should do to educate someone. They made education into an ugly thing that you hated, were bored by, feared, wanted to get as far away from as possible. There was no positive stimulation there. The whole system was terrible. I mean, it wasn't necessarily the fault of the teachers. The teachers were terrible, and they were strict people. But the whole system, the schools, that's the way they taught kids. You'd come in, you'd stand on line before the school opened up. You couldn't talk. You couldn't talk to anybody. You went and took your seats. You had to sit up and hold your hands on the desk. Yeah. I mean, it was just terrible. And so much of it was rote memorization of stuff that you had no interest in and never learned. And they made learning the opposite of what it should be. I mean, you, not only didn't you learn, but you were against learning for the rest of your life. You were against when they tried to teach you to read books. They made it so unpleasant. It was so joyless, and so the books they picked were so tepid and antiseptic and dull. And you had to do these book reports on them, and you never did any of the things. You hated math, you hated reading, you hated geography, history. Yeah. They made it all loathsome.
It's true. I remember was Dick and Jane and Spot the dog.
Well, that's when they first teach you to read. Yeah. I mean, I don't think they could have given you a stimulating novel then. But when they first teach you, they taught you like that. And even when it got into the older classes and they introduced you to real writers, you know, like Shakespeare, they made it so unattractive, so joyless and so boring and so, it was just so uninteresting that you never wanted to see Shakespeare again. You never wanted to see Edith Wharton again or any of those things. Now I think it's probably better for kids. I think they've learned over the years that there's other ways to get through to kids and teach them and to stimulate in them a real appetite for learning.
But we had a great advantage with all that crap. That disadvantage, we had the radio. And the radio for me, I guess for you, certainly loving radio days as I do, but that radio stimulated my imagination, and whatever success I feel I've had, if I had any, was because of that radio stimulation. I'm on the range, Woody, with the Lone Ranger. I'm walking down those stairs to Jack Benny's vault. I mean, it was fantastic. I hope you felt the same way.
I did because, there was no television when I grew up, and you could do other things with the radio. When the radio was on, my mother could cook and she could knit, and my father could, play cards with my uncle, and I could be working on my model airplane or something. And in those days, when you got up in the morning, 7 o'clock or something, the first thing you did, you turned on the radio. And while you were dressing and showering and having breakfast, the radio was on, and it was on, all in the early morning till you went to school. And in those days, what you heard on the radio, you heard Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw and Tommy Dorsey and the music of Cole Porter and George Gershwin played by those people, by great musicians. Billie Holiday, this was common radio stuff. And then when I would go off to school, there were all those things that the soap operas and things that my mother, my aunts could listen to while they were dusting and cleaning and getting lunch ready, because it wasn't a television. You didn't have to sit in front of it. So it was the radio. It was on all the time. And of course, when you come home from school, you wanted to hear all those kids' programs that were on at the time, all the exciting radio programs that were on in the afternoon, Captain Midnight and Hop Harrigan and the Green Lantern, all those things were on television, on the radio, and you look forward to them. And in the evening, in the prime time, they had wonderful shows, and they created worlds that you envisioned and inhabited. When you said, walk down the steps to Jack Benny, yes, Jack Benny would come on Sunday night, and you were taken theoretically into his home, and you were there in his home, and you it was a real thing for you in your mind that you created, that you envisioned. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And then television came along, and it required more focus, and so you couldn't do those other things. You had to sit in front of the television set at the exclusion of all the other household chores and activities.
I have to tell you that I go out sometimes and lecture at colleges, and when I tell them that there was no such thing as a remote for television, they don't believe me. I said, you couldn't be a couch potato. You had to get up. You had to turn the channel. You had to take those little things, the antennas, and move them around.
Rabbit ears,
right. I mean, you know, it was, you could not, you, there was no remote. How can that be? You know, it's amazing to me about things like that. You did in Radio Days, you took me back in the most nostalgia way. I remember, as you do, walking into that Radio City Music Hall the first time, and I'll never forget it. And you depicted it so well. Did it happen that way for you? I gather it did.
It did, yeah. When I grew up, there were movie palaces, the Radio City Hall, Music Hall being the epitome, but the Roxy and the Paramount and the Capitol, that was just in the New York, the Manhattan area. In Brooklyn, which was a lower middle class neighborhood, there were, on every other block, there would be a movie house, and it would be quite wonderful. You'd go in and it had red carpets and it had sconces and yellow lights, and it was big, and chandeliers and a huge screen.
And marble staircases,
yeah. And this was just in your lower middle class Brooklyn neighborhood. When you went into Manhattan and you went to the Radio City Music Hall, they had ushers in uniforms, and I mean, it was astonishing what went on. You know, I photographed in that movie Radio Days some of the bathrooms at the music hall. You can't believe them. I mean, they're art. Deco masterpieces. That was the highest form, was the Radio City Music Hall. But as I say, if you went to the Roxy, look, if I would be sitting at the Paramount, the movie would end, and suddenly rising out of the pit would be the Duke Ellington Orchestra, and they would be fabulous. They'd be playing Take the 8 Train, coming up out of the pit, and you couldn't believe it. You were in the 10th row or something, and when I would play hooky from school and go into the Paramount, I would go in at about, I think they opened like 10 in the morning, and it would be some cold, rainy winter morning, and at 10:30 in the morning or 11 o'clock in the morning, comics would go on. I would see Jackie Leonard or Phil Foster you'd be able to see them in these movie houses. They had very good stage shows eventually they had Martin and Lewis at the Capitol Theater uptown. They had Gypsy Rose Lee. They had Jackie Gleason and Art Carney did their sketches at the Capitol Theater. And as I say, you had Gypsy Rose Lee there. And at the Paramount, you had, Martin and Lewis and many wonderful comics and singers. Frank Sinatra, famously, at the Paramount. It was quite an era.
it was an incredible time. And while I'm a little younger, I would go to the Paramount, and I remember, as you say, the orchestra comes up, and then here comes Joni James. Joni James.
Wow. Uh-huh.
And she had so many hits at that point. I can't believe she's right in front of me, and she's singing these songs. Why don't you believe me? I mean, I really couldn't believe it. And I never feel to this day that I got over it. And it sounds like you didn't either.
No, I didn't. And it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. But yeah, very taken for granted at the time. I just figured, well, this is what it is. You go to the Roxy, you go to the Paramount, you go to the Capitol, and the Music Hall. And, you know, and in my neighborhood, I get out of bed and walk to the corner, and there was the Midwood Theater. And the theater was playing, you know, Casablanca and something else on a big screen. And the whole theater was, you know, full of people, and it was lit, and there were the marble staircases and the brass. And
those curtains, remember, Woody, the curtains going slowly, teasingly, up yeah. slowly. We didn't have that in the neighborhood theater. We had it downtown only.
Oh, no, we had it in the neighborhood theaters, and there were so many neighborhood theaters. I mean,
With curtains like that?
Not all with curtains. But there were so many theaters. If you wanted to see a movie now, if I want to see a movie, there's such a paucity of choice. But then, you know, I could walk out of my house and within walking distance, some farther than others, but within walking distance, there were 20 movie houses. I mean,
yeah,
and they showed everything.
Yeah, I had 12 that I could go to, and as you say, you just could see anything you wanted to, and the older theaters would put two what we would call A pictures together, because if you missed them, you could go see them at the end of their run, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask about, go ahead. You're going
to
say?
I was just going to say, you're too young to remember the movie houses. When I was a kid, some of those movie houses cost 12 cents to get into. You saw a double feature, the cartoons. You'd get a little comic book or a little present, a little magnet or something. And it cost you 12 cents to see the double feature.
Well, the only thing that's comparable is the Kingsbridge Theater on Kingsbridge Road during the week, children, 14 cents.
Okay. Well, there you have it.
That would be the closest. But we had a theater called the Windsor, which was sometimes played Broadway shows. They would go to each borough, but I never could afford that, and my parents didn't let me go, but they had what you must have grown up with, a double feature, a newsreel, cartoons, a coming attraction, and we had either a Roy Rogers or a Gene Autry Western. I couldn't believe it. I was in hog heaven. I'd go in 11, 12 o'clock and leave. It came out, it was nighttime.
Yeah,
we brought our sandwiches and people changed their seats.
I don't know if you remember this, but there were, you could go in and after the movie, you know, between for short subjects, there would be something like a racing car thing. Kids would race their homemade cars or something, and there'd be a race, and they'd race and crash and all things, and you would have gotten a number. And if your car wins, you could go to the manager's office and get a prize.
Oh, that's great. No, that I didn't have. Never even heard of it. That's why I'm glad we did this interview.
it was very, and you're right. You could take sandwiches and go to the movies and be there. And, you know, you were completely safe. I mean, your mother, when you were 9 years old, 8 years old, your mother could leave you in the movies on Saturday afternoon, you know, at 1 o'clock or something, and come back and get you at 6 o'clock. With no worry that anything was going to happen to you.
That's right. At 9 or 10 years old, I would take my 10 cents, go to the IRT subway, put it in the slot, there was no tokens, and go downtown. Downtown, as Petula Clark sang, was everything. Downtown was McGinnis, was the Grant's Hot Dogs, was Jack Dempsey's.
That's right.
It was like nothing I could compare it to, except maybe the terracotta soldiers in China.
Yeah. Yeah, there were. I remember Broadway in those days. That was Lindy's was on Broadway. Taffanetti's was on 42nd Street. The right. Automat was there. The Automat on like 45th Street or something?
I think you got to shoot the last one once.
Yeah, the last one was on 3rd Avenue, I think.
All the way east. Yeah, that's right.
East.
But yeah. I mean, I never had mashed potatoes or baked beans like that ever since.
I know. The food was delicious. It was taken for granted. You figured this is what's out there. Now you can't do that.
No. And I wonder if it was as good as it really tasted at the time. It was then. I wonder if we'd feel that way now.
I know the cherry pie and the coffee was sensational because I had that right up until my young manhood. I mean, I was already 20 years old or something, and I would go into the Automat, grab the newspaper, sit down, and have coffee, and that pie was delicious. So
Well, I think it's time for the original Phil Wasserman story, Phil Wasserman story, and how important that really turned out to be in your life.
Yeah, he was a relative of mine. And he was a press agent, and it's a tenuous connection to show business, but that's what he did. And when I showed him the jokes that I wrote, I mean, I was only a teenager in high school. He said, "These are good jokes. These are professional jokes. You should try sending them in to." At that time, there were so many columns and newspapers, so many newspapers and so many columns. You know, Walter Winchell was a big thing, and Earl Wilson, and Hi Gardner, and Frank Farrell, and I mean, just many of them. And he said, "Try sending them in. Maybe you'll." And I did, and they printed them, and suddenly I found myself as a high school student in Brooklyn, and my name kept appearing in the newspaper. I changed it right away, because I didn't want anybody to know that I was doing this. But I was appearing all the time, and suddenly some firm in New York called Earl Wilson on the Post and said, "Who is this guy that's appearing in your columns all the time with the saying funny things?" And he said, "He's some kid in Brooklyn. He comes home from school, and he types these jokes up and sends them in to me, and a lot of them are good, and I print them." So they called me in to the office, and they said, "Can you come in after school every day?" And you know, at that time, I had the only jobs I had prior were those jobs where you deliver for a tailor shop at 35 cents an hour, and you deliver for a butcher shop, that'd be 35 cents plus tips, and this kind of thing. Suddenly, I'm sitting on Madison Avenue and 61st Street, and a guy is saying to me, "If you come in after school and type jokes for us, we'll give you $40 a week."
Whoa.
And I'm thinking, you know, $40 a week. That's my mother makes $40 working in a flower shop, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And so you know, of course I took it, you know.
Of course.
And then that was my launching.
Well, all I know is that was the hell of a beginning. I think it was Nick Kenny's. I think it was Nick Kenny's column that you wrote the first joke.
Yeah, Nick Kenny was another
columnist like that. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk a little bit about your night with Leonard Lyons, another man who, by this time, you're successful. But Leonard Lyons has you for dinner, and then I think you take a trip with him, don't you?
Yeah, he was very nice, and I had at that time had some jokes in his column. I was just beginning to be a stand-up comedian, and he invited me to dinner at his house in the Beresford. I had dinner with he and his wife, and then he took me on his rounds, and it was a wonderful thing for me because he took me to the Oak Room of the Plaza, and he took me to the World of Astoria, and he took me to Tut Shores, and he took me to Lindy's. And this was, things I'd only read about Pryor, and it was a remarkable experience for me. I was hanging out, at least as an observer, with all these nightlife New York social and show business people, and getting to observe them in action. And there was, you know, for me, it was a dreamlike experience. Yeah.
And a little bit almost like, as you wrote, Cafe Society.
Cafe Society was a big thing at the time.
And a lovely movie to boot that you wrote and directed. I want to ask you, if we can, about how come you kind of paint yourself as a shy boy. How did you get your nerve up to do stand-up, and who encouraged you, and how frightened were you at the beginning?
I was real frightened at the beginning and at the end. I was a writer for years, and a writer sits alone in a room and writes. And or you may be in a room with one other writer sometimes, or a couple of other writers, but you are not facing an audience telling jokes. And my then manager, Jack Rollins, insisted that I do this, pushed me and pushed me and pushed me. I told him, I have nothing to offer. He said, trust me, just do what I tell you for a year. And let's look up after the year and let's see what happens. And he was very persuasive and highly reputable and highly intelligent and very decent human being. And I tried it. I put my faith in him. And I went out there and told jokes every night. And I was scared all the time. Whenever I was, for all the years that I did it, I was scared every show, every year. But I did it, and I thought nothing of it. I mean, except I was fearful. But I succeeded instantly. It's the first night that I was at the Blue Angel, it was the first time I ever went on. I was scared out of my wits, and I went on, and I thought I was terrible. And the next day, he got offers from television shows and from nightclubs. I could do no wrong when I started being a stand-up comedian. It's like I could do, as scared as I was, as self-deprecating, I just couldn't seem to fail at it at the time, even though I didn't feel I was doing anything worthwhile. And maybe I wasn't. I don't know. Maybe it just was the flavor of the month at the time, but I was very lucky.
But you often don't feel you're doing anything worthwhile, and there are those of us who totally disagree and think that your films are terrific, that you're a great talent. I loved coming to the cafe, the Hotel Carlyle, to watch you play. I mean, I don't know how. It's just as well we don't see each other that much, because you'd say, stop telling me these things. But I just think what you have is an extraordinary gift.
Very nice of you to say that, but I'm 88, and I remain unconvinced.
I'm not changing you. I know.
I don't think I'm going to change.
It's true. All right. So let's get to the first movie you write, which is a movie you don't like particularly as it finishes up. But
I didn't like it because someone else made it. I was the screenwriter for What's New Pussycat, and I felt that they mangled my movie. Now, again, it was the most successful commercial comedy to its time. It made the most money of any comedy to its time. But I thought it was junk. And if I was to see it, I wouldn't see it. But if I was to be abducted and having to see it, I would still think it was junk.
But we have to thank that movie, because you said, never again. If I write it, I'm going to direct it.
Yes, exactly, because I didn't want my script to be mangled again. And I was lucky I wrote the script, Take the Money and Run. And I was, fortunately at that time, a new company formed, Palomar Pictures. And because they were a new company, they couldn't really attract, John Huston and, the great directors at the time. So they took a chance with me. For $1 million, they'd make that movie. That was the budget of the movie. And it was a big success.
At the 68th Street Playhouse, I think it may have played a year. It was just very old.
Yeah, I was very lucky in my career. I got all the breaks that you needed. And that's one of the reasons I'm so disenchanted with the movie situation now. I put the movie in there. It played a year. I had the Annie Hall in town. It played a year, more than a year. Now you put a movie in town and it plays 2 weeks and it goes on streaming on television. This is not fun for the director.
No,
so, it's demoralizing for the film director to have his film, played to audiences on a big screen for 2 weeks, and then it's always on the small box at home.
Yeah, or if lucky, if it's 2 weeks, sometimes right to streaming.
Oh, yes, sure.
But
that's better for them.
I think I'm going to tell you a story you don't know. I'm so excited to reveal it to you, and I hope you maybe remember a bit of it. The man who headed Palomar was a friend of mine, Edgar Sherrick.
I liked him.
Yeah, he was really something. And he said to me, when Woody made Take the Money and Run, we were all in a room together reading the reviews and coming up with an ad. Woody was in the corner looking at the reviews and said to himself, but aloud, I could hear him. He said, if they like this, isn't that interesting? So somehow you knew that you could do better than that. And if they like that, you were going to
be. Yes, I always was deluded in thinking I could do better. Anytime I made a film, I always would look at it, having worked on it, cut it, and I'd see the final thing. And I'd always think, oh, God, where did I go wrong? How could I do this? I can, believe me, trust me, I can do better than this. And, I always had that feeling because you start out thinking that you're going to make Citizen Kane or you're going to make, something great. And you work and you work and then you cut it together and you put the music in. You look at it and suddenly you see that not only is it not Citizen Kane, but it's a mess and you're going to change everything and recut it and put in stuff and change the music and do anything. You just want to survive. You abandon the ambition of making a wonderful movie. You just want to make a movie that's not a total disaster and an embarrassment. And that's where you wind up. That's where I've wound up in my film career. Film after film after film. And I've made 50 films now. I've written and directed 50 films. And I would say most of them, I wind up in the cutting room thinking, my God, are we ever going to be able to make this thing into something respectable or as we may as well throw it away now.
Well, I have to tell you that I have at least 12 to 15 of my favorite films were made by this man I'm talking to. So, but we'll talk about some of them, but let's talk about United Artists. They come in, they see you take the money and run. They're willing to give you a deal that I still can't believe you got, which is it's your movie. You got final cut. You can make whatever you want, and you want to make The Jazz Baby.
Yes, I wanted to make, I always wanted to make serious films. And so I came in with this very serious film about a jazz musician that had many problems, which I later made with Sean Penn, some version of it. And and that's what I wanted to make. And they were flabbergasted. That's not what they wanted. They wanted something funny. And they said, gee, we're not thrilled with this. And they expected me to say, well, I'm sorry. I get, it's my choice, not yours. But I would never do that to a film company. I would never make a film that they weren't happy with just because I had final cut and had all that freedom. I never exercised any of that in any tyrannical way. I said, fine, if you don't like this, I'll give you something else. I don't want you to put your money into something that you're not enthused over. So I made Bananas, and that they liked.
Well, they were confused about it. I think I told you once, Jim Veldy called me over and said, look, we got this movie. I don't know what to do with it. Would you look at it? You're young. My qualification was not that I had taste or intelligence. Mm-hmm. I was young. So I went to see it. I loved it. And I put it in the coronet, as I told you. I loved it. I just went crazy for it. But
it was
Bananas.
Yes. It was Bananas was a big success all over the world. I mean, it was a very popular film.
Very. And then everything you want to know about Sex and Sleeper and Love and Death and all these films that are funny and enjoyable and entertaining. And then you kind of hit gold with Annie Hall. But Annie Hall was going to be a mystery initially. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. I wrote a mystery with those characters in it, and I didn't really like it, and put it away, and then made Love and Death, and then I decided. You see, it required a certain amount of courage. Now, this is show business courage. This is not courage on the battlefield. This is show business courage to make a film. I'd been used to making films that were all jokes, one joke after another, one laugh. That's what I tried to do, was make films like that. Then here I was making a film with Annie Hall where I was sacrificing laughs all over the place for involvement in the story and with the people. And people around me, many people said, don't do that because people want to laugh, and why would you want to make something like that? And I thought, I just felt that was where I wanted to go. And I went there, and it turned out to be very successful for me. I was taken aback by the enormous response it got.
Let's get it straight. 4 Academy Awards, 1 for the best picture, 1 for the best screenplay, 1 for the best director, and 1 for Diane Keaton as best actress. So you did, it really must have changed the whole trajectory of your career, in your own head at least, somewhat, no?
No, it created the illusion that I knew what I was doing and that I could make these things happen. I couldn't, and I didn't know what I was doing. And I didn't, it was a film, and I was lucky with its response. But when you have a big success, people think, you did it. You know what you're doing, and you can do it at will. But I couldn't do it at will, at all. I mean, it was.
No one can. Nobody can.
Well, nobody can. But they think you can. They think you can, that you have more control over it than you have. And a lot of it's luck.
Well, you certainly changed gears after Annie Hall, and I guess because of your adulation for Ingmar Bergman, you make Interiors, which confuses the public. They don't understand that the man has made them laugh and entertain is now making what appears to be a grim film. I was disappointed as an audience member, I remember. Mm-hmm. But Woody, I just watched it, which of course you'll never do again. You don't watch any of your movies, but it's a wonderful movie. I couldn't believe how good it is. But at the time, nope, not for me. And now, years later, with everything that's gone on in this world, it's really, what a cast. Geraldine Page, E.G. Marshall, Maureen Stapleton, Sam Waterston, Diane Keaton. And it's a really interesting film. But
I'm glad you feel that way. I don't know, because I haven't seen it since I made it. But, one thing, I've always been undeterred by you know, the audience or the critics or people around me, or you know, I want to make what I want to make, and if it was that film at that time, and I wanted to make that, it didn't bother me. I mean, I knew in the course of my making my 50 films that there were films I was making. I knew when I was making them, it was never going to have an audience or never going to be popular. But the alternative is that you don't make it then. If you're afraid that critics won't like it, if you're afraid people won't come to it, then you don't make it. So you have the choice. Either you make it and you know you're going to take a critical beating and that the audience is not going to show up, or you don't make it and you make something that you're confident will be more popular and more accepted. I chose always to make the one I wanted. And again, I say this is courage, but it's show business courage, because if you make a flop film, nobody shoots you like on the battlefield where you're courageous and you get shot.
Yeah, well, but if you're courageous and you win awards, that means a little bit. But I'm sure, knowing you a little as I do, it's not the big thing for you.
It's not anything that I set out to do. No. I wanted to have the money to make the films I wanted to make, and I wanted people to leave me alone and just let me make them. And I've been blessed because I've had that kind of deal my whole life in film. That's why I say anytime I have a bad film or I do something wrong, I have no one to blame but myself. I mean, I have complete control over what film I make, what casting I do, how I want to finish it, color it, put the music in. So if a thing is not good, there's nobody to blame but me. I've been very lucky to have that kind of creative freedom.
Yeah, I would rather look at it as fortunate rather than luck, because to me, luck implies you had nothing to do with it. And I think the idea that fortunate and talent is what did it. But okay, I want to ask a couple of things. You had mentioned to me once that I think it was the movie Manhattan that you weren't in town for the opening, and that somehow not being in town for, I guess, closure was bothersome to you. Am I right about that?
No, you're half right. I was in town. I finished the picture and I went to Paris. And I was with Jean Dumanian and we both went to Paris. We had a nice time. The picture opened while I was away. And I had no regrets whatsoever. I was having a wonderful time in Paris. And, and I never gave a second thought anything else. The picture was exceptionally well received, and that was very nice. But I wasn't there at the screening of it at the theater when it was screened, and I wasn't there when it opened, and it didn't bother me at all. I mean, it would have bothered me to be there.
Well, at least I got it half right.
Yeah, you got it half right.
Yeah, not bad. I want to ask you a little bit about Ralph Rosenblum, who was your first editor. And I gather he had some influence on you in the editing room. Is that valid?
Yeah, he was my second editor. I worked with Jim Heckert the first time, a very good editor. And then, but he was in California and I came back to New York. And so I worked with Ralph. Ralph was a truly great editor and taught me everything I know about editing. Because, I didn't know about anything. I didn't know about cameras till I worked with Gordon Willis. I didn't know about editing till I worked with Ralph Rosenblum. I mean, I knew, the basic things. You cut here and cut there. But I really got some lessons in editing from a stylish, wonderful editor in Ralph Rosenblum. And years later, when I worked with Gordon Willis, I got lessons in cinematography that have stayed with me.
Well, I think it's time, if you don't mind, to kind of discuss the writing process, because I think I'm fair to say that if someone said, you can only do one thing, Mr. Allen, I think you would choose writing, I think.
Yeah, I would. I would choose writing because I can do it at home, laying on my bed. And, you know, yes. And then if you don't like it, you tear it up and it doesn't cost anything. Whereas if you make a film and you don't like it, you know, it's cost millions of dollars and you got to put it out there anyhow because they got to make something back.
Well, so the process, as I remember you telling me, is you get up kind of early. And yeah. the hardest part of writing for you is not the writing, but what goes before it.
Thinking out what your plot's going to be and what the story is, the characters. Once you get to the writing part, it's much easier. You've already solved all the problems of, you know, where the plot's going and what you want to say and what the characters are like. And
so, okay. We're talking in terms of what the writing process is, and your characters are created by you. And I think Patty Chayefsky once said something to the effect that all the characters are part of you. You think that's true? Or did Patty ever say that? Or am I half right again?
No, that I don't know. He never said it to me. He may have said that because I've heard that quote. He was a very fine screenwriter, a very fine television and then screenwriter. And I never knew about the characters. I mean, I just wrote what seemed to me logical at the time and amusing or suspenseful or funny. And, I never thought about any of that stuff. That's why I would not be a good teacher in class. I would never know what to tell the kids. It's all, with me, it's all instinctive and it either works or it doesn't, but I don't know exactly what I'm doing. I mean, there's no structured method to it.
Except that you do know you like to write every day if you
yes,
can.
Yes, I enjoy it.
Yes. Now, can you tell the story to, well, at least I remember, funny how you remember things that we all know as part of some of your movies about memory, but let's talk in terms of, do you still have a cigar box where the ideas, if you come up with an idea, you kind of throw it in?
Not the cigar box. No, I have a little bureau in my house, you know, where I have a lamp on it and a telephone next to my bed, you know, the typical night table. And I have a couple of drawers in it. And in those drawers, if I get an idea during the year, you know, that seems like an inspired idea or a good idea or a fair idea, I write it down and throw it in the drawer. Then when I'm going to write, I take out those ideas, some written on napkins, some written on the back of envelopes like the Gettysburg Address. You know, there are all ideas. And I put them down on the bed and I look, and most of them, I think, my God, what was I thinking? This is terrible. And I throw it away. But occasionally an idea comes across that's not so bad. And I develop it into a movie.
Well, I think we've got the first part of the first lesson about how you write.
Yeah, that is how I write.
Yeah, get the idea, put it away, and maybe if it percolates, it looks like something you want to do, perhaps. Have you abandoned during writing anything at times?
Abandoned what?
Abandoned the writing at times. You're writing along and you say, this is not working.
God, yes, absolutely. I mean, it's not like everything works out. I can be 50 pages into something and I abandon it or 80 pages and I can't get an ending for it and I abandon it. Absolutely. I mean, I guess wrong or take a wrong turn someplace, and yeah.
How about writer's block? Have you experienced it at all?
I've never experienced writer's block. No, I've never had a block. I enjoy writing, and I write. I mean, I'm not saying things flow all the time. I if I'm trying to get an idea, you know, it may be agonizing weeks of thinking, but it's not writer's block. It's not that I'm blocked and months have gone by and I can't write or, or there's something blocking me. No, that's never happened.
Well, we're now going to talk a little bit, if we can, about your directing process. And part of it, it seems to me, and you'll tell me again if I'm right or half right, and that's the fact that you'll come to the set not necessarily prepared, but work with the director of photography, Carlo or Vittorio or whomever, and you kind of work it out how you want to do it and then bring the actors in. Is that right?
Yes, you're right there. I don't think about it. I never know what we're going to shoot, really. I never take one of those sheets that has all the information on it when you leave. I go home when I'm finished, and I don't think about it. I watch the ball game, or I'm just not interested. And I go in the next morning. I don't know exactly. I say, they give me a sheet. I say, I'm going to shoot this scene. Okay, fine. I know what the scene is. I wrote it. And I look at the set, and I figure out what I want to see, and I call over the cameraman and say, I'm thinking of this, and we talk a little. And he may say to me, I saw this set, I have a wonderful idea for it, and it may be very different than my idea and better than my idea. But usually I or we talk over a scene, and I figure it out, and then I tell the actors where to walk and what to pick up and what to do. Now, once in a while, an actor will say to me, I don't feel comfortable walking over there, and I never, ever make an actor do anything they're not comfortable. I never make them wear a costume they don't like. I never make them walk any place or do anything they don't like. And if they don't like the dialogue in the script, I never make them say it. I say, well, then, put it in your own words. If you're asking your wife for a divorce or something, say it the way you want to say it. And if you make a mistake or if it's not good, I'll tell you and we'll do it again some other way. I keep it very loose. A lot of faith in the actors, and 90% of the time, I don't ever have to direct an actor. Someone comes to the set, and they've read the script, they've agreed to do the movie, they know what they're doing, they're gifted, they come in and they do it, and I don't, hover over them, like a helicopter mother or something. I leave them alone, and if they're screwing up, I tell them, that's this is not going to work. We have to take a different idea. But, most of the time I never have to tell them anything. And they think, because I don't talk to them, that I don't like it. But that's not true. I don't talk to them because there's nothing I can add to their performance. Now, once in a while, I will talk to them and say, could you do that scene a little angrier, or could you do one more take a little faster, pick up the tempo a little? But, I'm not a big one for meeting with them beforehand or referencing, look, you're George, he's a businessman and his brother died in the war, and because of that you think this. And I don't go over any of that. I mean, it doesn't interest me, and I don't think it helps the actor. And if I get what I want from the actor, I'm happy. And if I don't, I try and tell him, faster and louder.
That's what Mike, when I did a film on Mike Nichols, it was Meryl Streep or Nathan Lane or Matthew Broderick. I'd say, what was it? Was there one thing he always did? They said every once in a while he'd say, do everything you just did, but do it faster.
Yeah.
So yeah. I guess that seems to be a consistency.
I heard, what's his name? I can't remember, the French director who would say, you do a few takes, and he would say, that's absolutely perfect. You got everything perfect. That was brilliant. Now do it again faster.
Yeah.
And because in comedy, speed is, half the battle.
I know that you said, just now, that you let the actor sound better, but I know you do care about the punchline.
Well, yeah. I mean, if the actor ruins the punchline. But the actors I use don't ruin the punchline. They enhance them. Who am I working with? I'm working with whether it was Diane Keaton or Tony Roberts over the years, the people I've worked with knew what they were doing. Mia Farrow was a good actress. Diane Wiest was a wonderful actress. I've worked with so many people. I worked with Robin Williams. I worked with Billy Crystal. I worked they know what's funny. They're better than I know, and they're fine. And if somebody ruins a punchline, once in a while you get an actor who just has no flair for comedy. It'd be maybe a very good actor, but just no flair for comedy. And you have to try and give them a little help. But no amount of help really seems to work. I mean, either you have a gift for comedy or you don't.
Yes, either they understand the rhythm or they don't get it.
Yeah, you have to feel it.
One of the things about, I remember you saying that in Crimes and Misdemeanors, Martin Landau was in so many ways your voice, and it turned out that he was a couple of blocks away from you in Brooklyn.
Yeah. I was astounded how I kept saying to people, gee, every line in this thing that Marty Landau reads, every scene he reads instinctively correct. He says it just the way I hear it in my head. And then I learned that we grew up a few blocks apart in Brooklyn.
Yeah, so, but the thing about Crimes and Misdemeanors that, well, there's so many things about that movie I love, but I mean, I guess we would say the eyes have it. There is so much about the eyes in that, starting with Judah being this great eye doctor, but Sam Waterston, the only real hero for me in the picture, becomes blind. Angelica Houston's eyes are open when Landau looks down. I mean, the eyes were so... Was that always in your head right from the beginning?
Well, a little of it was, but as I developed the film, as I was shooting the film, things came to me, opportunities presented themselves. You know, for instance, when Angelica was laying on the floor, you know, I hadn't thought in the writing stage, she's laying on the floor with her eyes open. But when I saw her laying there, I thought, gee, her eyes could be open, and that would support the theme in a way that, I at least as director think is meaningful. Maybe nobody in the world will, but I will have her eyes open. Yes. And so I do, and I guess right, because nobody in the world did.
Yeah, well, it's a terrific movie, and it kind of seems to me that it had a novelistic approach to it that I don't think you had done in other films as much. Kind of like a Dickens, where all these characters are introduced and then come together. Do you think that was true at all?
Yes, I think it's true. I think it was true of Hannah and Her Sisters, and I think it's true of of that.
Tell me about Coup de Grâce. It's so interesting to me. I like the movie a lot, but I'm interested to know, yes, you wrote it, but you don't speak fluent French. I think you studied French a little, though, didn't you?
I got a couple of words in French, but I never had to use them. I never had to speak any words of French. All the actors spoke English, and I would tell them what to do when I needed to, and they understood me completely. And, you know, and you can tell when you're watching a scene, even if it's in a different language. If you watch a Kurosawa film, you can see the Japanese actors. You know who the great ones are and who the good performances are. And who when you see a French film and you see Jean Gabin or Belmondo or Gérard Depardieu, you can see they're great and they're doing a scene. It's instinctive. So I had no problem. I would see the scene. I would talk to the actors and say, you know, do this with a lot of anger or something, some little stupid direction, and they would do it, and they would be fine. I might have to say more anger or less anger or faster, you know, but I rarely had to say anything. And when they did it properly, I could tell right away, no problem. It was not hard. to do it in French. It was quite easy, actually.
And it's easy to see. You can get it on Apple. You can get it on Amazon. I got it. I watched it. I really liked it. That leading lady, Lou,
Yeah, she's wonderful.
Whoa.
I was blessed with a great cast. Every actor in it, every actress in it came through for me. And she was a discovery. I mean, I never heard of her. And I was looking at some tapes when I was casting. And I said, who's that girl? She's so beautiful and she's such a good actress. And I never heard the name before.
No.
And she was just a treat to work with. And Melville, who played her husband, they were all great. I've been very lucky, very blessed over the years.
I'll take blessed. I'll take fortunate. I will not accept luck. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, I know you have to go. How do I thank you? I just can't thank you enough, Woody. I just love talking to you.
No problem. I always enjoy talking to you when you drop over to the set of a play we're doing or something, and be very happy to continue this at some time, and we can go over the stuff you didn't get to.
Oh, yes. I've got stuff.
Thanks for joining us on Julian Schlossberg's Movie Talk. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.